This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The American West continues to endure the worst drought in more than 1,200 years. Let me say that again. It is the worst drought in the West in more than 1,200 years. In New Mexico, more than 90% of the land there is currently in extreme or exceptional drought. And every year across the West, the drought reveals new ways that it's permanently changing the landscape and how people live on it. This year, there's a painful irony that's led to New Mexico's record-breaking wildfires. They were started intentionally, prescribed burns whose purpose is to clear forests of dry fuel that could ignite into uncontrolled wildfires. But those prescribed burns themselves got out of control. The Hermit's Peak and Calf Canyon fires combined to consume more than 335,000 acres, and they remain only 70% contained. President Biden visited New Mexico last weekend.
Thousands of people displaced, ranchers wiped out, schools shuttered, and wilderness that looks like a moonscape, if you see parts of it where I was able to see. And I'm thinking about what you're thinking, and that is our responsibility. It's not a gift. We have a responsibility to help this state recover, to help the families who have been here for centuries, and the beautiful northern New Mexico villages who can't go home and whose livelihoods have been fundamentally changed.
The federal government has accepted responsibility for the wildfires and has committed to covering 100% of the cost of debris removal and emergency protective measures. But the threat posed by the fires reached beyond charred acreage. New Mexico's governor, Democrat Michelle Lujan Grisham, says the wildfires are endangering critical water sources.
We need help with debris removal, watershed protection for our rivers, streams, and acequias, the water which is the lifeblood of all but these communities in particular.
And one of those communities is Las Vegas, New Mexico, population about 13,000. And Luis Trujillo is that city's mayor, and he joins us now. Mayor Trujillo, welcome to On Point.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, Mr. Mayor, can you tell me sort of what the current conditions are like in and around Las Vegas, New Mexico?
So definitely dealing with the mega drought, things around are brown. Las Vegas used to be a very green community. Everybody had lawns and the rolling hills to the east of us were always so green and beautiful. And now there's just a complete shade of brown everywhere. So it's dry and hot today and unseasonably windy for this time of year. And that is what really caused those fires to go out of control. And the winds were so fierce during that time, you know, 50 mile an hour sustained winds and 80 mile an hour gusts while the fire was burning the hottest. Mm-hmm. Still today, waking up, there's a smell of smoke, visible smoke, you know, in the horizon, and you can smell smoke, not as much as when the fire was close to Las Vegas and almost creeped into our city. We were one ridge away from catastrophe for our city. On the west side of Las Vegas is a Crestone Ridge, and the fire burned right along that ridge. And fortunately for Las Vegas, it didn't creep into our town.
Yeah. Well, but it got awfully close. And can you tell me what stopped the fire from actually getting into town?
Yeah, we were very blessed that the Forest Service had lots of human resources on that fire, including aircraft when it wasn't windy. So the times that it wasn't windy, they were busy, you know, putting their retardant on that ridge and then fighting the fire right behind that ridge. So they knew that if it came over that ridge, it would be a whole different story for this town.
I see.
And so they dumped a lot of resources on that fire around the perimeter of Las Vegas on the west slopes of the Sangre de Cristos. So we were fortunate in that way, but now comes the other stress. So the fire is not in our area anymore, per se. It's still in our county, near the Pecos wilderness. And now the different stress today that we're living with is the watershed issue, yeah, and the burn scars along the watershed.
So Mayor Trujillo, just I'm definitely going to come to that in a second here, but I want to emphasize that, you know, I appreciate you you know, counting your blessings about not the fire not coming into Las Vegas, New Mexico, but just to underscore the point that you and other New Mexicans have made, there are many towns and villages that haven't been so lucky in the state because of these massive historic fires. I mean, you grew up there. And have you ever seen anything like this, the wildfire this large, this early in the season?
Never. You know, the fire season usually begins in June. Ours started in April. And unseasonably warm, unseasonably windy, as you can see. But, you know, I've never experienced this. A cumulative memory from my past, you know, when I was a child, the river used to flow bank to bank every spring. And we were warned not to get into the river. And, you know, we had snow every week. The Halloween, you know, Halloween week was always our first snowstorm, and we had snow every week. I remember that because I used to walk to school, and 3 feet, 4 feet of snow every single week. Now, if we get two of those storms a year, we're lucky. And the river does not flow like that anymore. The river is just, you can jump over it now. As opposed to when we were kids, that river used to flow from bank to bank. And, you know, there every spring we were afraid of the runoff. So right now the river is very, very barely trickling. Hmm. And so, to answer your question, I don't recall. Yeah. The severity of a drought like this.
Well, you are describing a completely different climate from when you grew up, which is just, it's a really visceral way of understanding how much the drought is changing the landscape in the West and in New Mexico. Now, to talk about the next concern that communities like Las Vegas, New Mexico have. Again, I mean, it's this terrible irony. First of all, there's drought, which has reduced the amount of critical water already. And second of all, these fires are threatening those water supplies for another reason. Can you tell me why?
Well, you know, up and down the burns, watershed, there are several burn scars, severe burn scars. And so, you know, the experts are telling us that we have to prepare our town for flooding because so much of the watershed burned and there's nothing to hold that water. The soil is covered in ash, so it doesn't absorb the water and sort of slides off, like if you would put water on baby powder, for example. The water just washes down. So any along the banks of the Guaynas River, that is going to happen, and trees that have burnt are going to fall, and they are going to come into the river. And a large rain event, experts say, even if it rains heavily for 15 minutes, we're in great danger of a flood in town. So there's lots of stress, lots of preparation, you know, plus Guaynas River is our only lifeline for water. So we have to move fast in installing debris catchment systems and filters and you know, settling ponds and whatever we have to do, work around the clock to try and beat Mother Nature to a rainstorm to make sure that water does not enter into our reservoirs and then consequently into our treatment system.
Yeah.
So Corps of Engineers right now started work on Saturday to install catchment systems and alarm systems up and down that watershed.
Huh. Mayor Trujillo, you're describing a world right now where fire season is earlier and more intense than ever. Then there's the concern about protecting already reduced water sources in the aftermath of fire season. Then there's just the daily changes that have happened in places like Las Vegas, New Mexico. No outdoor watering, no washing cars, no swimming pools, except for with a couple of exceptions. I mean, is this just the new way of life in Las Vegas, New Mexico?
It is. It is. It's been a way of life for several years, Magna. Unfortunately, our citizens have lived under a constant stage of water conservancy. So we have had one stage or another of water conservation. You know, the citizens do such a great job at conserving water here. And so the city also has a very, very strict conservancy plan in place so that we reserve as much water as we can. So the citizens do a great job of protecting, you know, our natural resources. So unfortunately, that is the new reality. You know, we have to, you know, what every street used to have, every house used to have a lawn, and now there's you know, there's xeriscape everywhere, which is probably smarter now in the West. Yeah, it's just a new reality and something that we have to get used to, along with trying to procure, you know, additional water sources for the city.
Mm. Well, Mayor Luis Trujillo is mayor of Las Vegas, New Mexico, community of about 13,000 people in New Mexico. He also grew up there. Mayor Trujillo, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you and your fellow Las Vegans all the best, okay?
Thank you, Magna. I appreciate being on your show.
Well, we are talking about the ongoing changes that the Western mega drought is bringing to the American West, and today we're focusing on what that new reality is in the state of New Mexico that's experiencing the earliest and most severe wildfires in that state's history. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking yet another look at the Western mega drought across the American West, the worst drought in 1,200 years. It's not often that you can say something like that, but it is happening. And today we're taking a close look at what's going on in the state of New Mexico. Joining us now is John D'Antonio. He served as New Mexico's top water official from 2003 to 2011 and again from 2019 to 2021 as the state's engineer. He's co-owner and principal program director of American West Water Advisors, and he's with us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. John D'Antonio, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hello, Meghna. It's a pleasure being here.
So, first of all, Mr. D'Antonio, I was wondering if I just wanted to ask you about the wildfires, the Calf Canyon and Hermit's Peak fires, because they started burning so early due to those prescribed burns that I mentioned at the top of the show. And it is just painful to know that an attempt to actually reduce the amount of fuel in New Mexico's forest has led to this historic fire. First of all, can you just tell me what you think about that?
Well, watershed health has always been an important concept in New Mexico, and we're subject to these back and forth seasons where we have maybe one or two normal years of precipitation. The undergrowth happens quickly. It grows under our forests and lays that foundation, and then we have continued drought years that make that debris just very combustible, and then you get a situation really where we have what we call a La Niña effect, which is an atmospheric effect that brings the storm pattern north of New Mexico. It creates drier conditions for New Mexico with high winds and winds that are sustainable. So you have the perfect recipe for dry conditions, some fuel, and you know, and just the warming temperatures early on, and the fires. There's no such thing as the prescribed burns just shouldn't happen in the springtime because the winds are so volatile, especially in a La Nina year.
Okay, but they did though.
They did, yes.
And so it sounds like you're saying pretty clearly that was a mistake by the Forest Service.
Well, I think so, and I don't want to second guess their decision making. But when you have the conditions that are ripe and the La Nina conditions are such that winds come up when you least expect them. Maybe even forecasted winds they're not necessarily accurate. And so, we had the same effect a few years ago in 2011, 2012, another big fire in Santa Clara Canyon, which denuded that entire watershed. And as Mayor Trujillo spoke, and, you know, my heart goes out to all the residents there and to Mayor Trujillo, there are problems. The Corps of Engineers actually, through their Advanced Measures Program, came in and put some flood control structures, gabion structures in there that greatly reduced the risk for Santa Clara Pueblo. It's going to be something similar that's going to be required. And we still have to be really lucky that we don't get a big storm, but while the construction happens and you put those structures in place, because a right storm or, you know, a big storm in a correct location is going to cause or potentially cause catastrophe for that area, the watershed above it.
Hmm. Now, I just want to focus. I know you're not second-guessing the Forest Service here, and I understand that, and they're also not here to explain to us why they decided to do the prescribed burns. But in light of the fact of what Mayor Trujillo said earlier, that really the entire way of life is changing in New Mexico and other Western states— it also sounds as if part of the change that needs to happen is decision making around forest management in New Mexico. Would you agree?
Well, I do agree, and there are some programs. The Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department and their Watershed Forestation Division, they have done a lot over the last few years. It's just that you have this trend with the Earth warming in response to increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide. The warming results in a greater we're looking at an aridification of the state in many parts of the world, just especially in New Mexico. And the impacts include warmer temperatures. You know, you have decreased water supply. You have thinner snowpacks, earlier spring melting. You have lower soil moisture levels, increased frequency of which leads to that intensity of the wildfire. And then you have an increased competition and demand for scarce water resources. We're just headed in a direction that's very negative with respect to our water supply.
Mm. Well, so just to be fair, the Forest Service has commented on what happened with those prescribed burns. And I'm seeing here that Michelle Burnett, a representative for the Forest Service, says that the Forest Service is committed to conducting prescribed fire under safe conditions. In rare circumstances, conditions change and prescribed burns move outside the planned project area and become wildfires. It is imperative that we learn from these experiences. That's from a representative from the Forest Service. But it's so tragic about how this happened in New Mexico. Governor Grisham calling on USDA to really take a hard look at their management practices, their fire management practices, to really more aggressively account for climate change. Because one of the interesting things I'm seeing here, and Mr. D'Antonio, correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like investigators have announced that the Calf Canyon fire, the planned burn there was actually conducted in January, or much earlier this year, and that there was a sleeper fire there that was dormant from January, survived some snowfall, and then roared back to life in April. How does that happen?
Well, the dry conditions and wind. You know, if you look at any fire that if you start your own little fire, you add wind to dry kindling, and that's how fires begin. And you can just imagine out in an area. Especially in New Mexico now, the snowpack used to be a lot thicker, more robust. It used to go down to probably 6,000 feet in elevation, all the way up to the 12,000 foot peaks. And now we're not getting snow in those elevations. It's more restricted to 9,000, probably to 12,000 feet in elevation. And so you just have drier conditions all the way down in those forested areas. So, yes, it definitely can happen. Mm.
So I am looking at the current map from the U.S. Drought Monitor for New Mexico, and I'm seeing a state that's either deep, deep, deep dark red for exceptional drought or bright red for extreme drought, almost the entire state. Can you describe to me sort of in concrete terms, what does that mean about water conditions across all of New Mexico?
Well, it means that, and this has been the norm for over the last 20 years, and ever since I became state engineer in 2003, we've had enormous water supply challenges. And so we've had shortages in every single water basin within the state of New Mexico, which necessitates us to go in as an administrative body when I was a state engineer and do and conduct shortage sharing amongst communities. We have to go in and enforce. You know, we're part of a prior appropriation system, which is 18 Western states in the United States. That means first in time, first in right. Whoever puts water to beneficial use first has that right. And so when you get into a drought status, the junior most rights wind up having to be shut off or turned off and let the seniors get their water. So we've been having to do active management for the last 20 years.
Mm, okay. For the last 20 years. Okay. So in 2003, that's when you first became New Mexico's top water official. What were conditions like then?
We were getting into another very bad drought scenario, and we recognized that from the outset. So one of my priorities was to start what we talked about, what we put in place was an active water resource management philosophy, which means going in and putting tools in place to manage water. So we put metering and measuring devices in most of our key watersheds within the state. We put water masters out in the field to help with the management of the water supplies. We started with our water databases, and we put all the tools in place because we knew and understood that this drought was going to continue. And that's where I get a little bit saddened, I guess, with the political support that we've had with an agency like the State Engineer's Office, where we had all the tools in place. We needed to do administratively work with an alternative means of administration versus the prior appropriation system. Prior appropriation is really you come in with a big hammer and you start trying to shut people's water off. It doesn't work in reality. The best way to do that is to work from the stakeholder level up and talk about alternative administration opportunities in which you can actually transfer on a short-term basis water rights typically from an agricultural use to a municipal, industrial, commercial use. And you can actually manage yourself through drought conditions. Mm. And so we started that initiative back in 2003, got legal challenges. Nobody wanted everybody wants the status quo when it comes to water. Got challenged. It took until 2012, the year I left, a few months after the New Mexico Supreme Court finally validated everything the State Engineer's Office did with respect to active water resource management, and said basically, we can manage water by priority or by the best information in our files without having the entire state adjudicated, which was a big win for water administration within the state. Yet the administration's support of the agency in getting technical people in, lawyers in, to actually put together regulations that were those stakeholder-driven processes was not there. So it delayed the ability for us to actively manage the resources by putting those regulations in place.
Yeah. You know, Mr. D'Antonio, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, so a little further west than where you are and further north. But I am familiar, just by having grown up out there, with the complexity of water regulation and water laws and water resource management across all of the Western states. And but I'm saying that because even having grown up there, it's still confusing to me, let me tell you. So I'm wondering if we could actually just simplify a little, because I think it will help listeners understand sort of all the different layers that you just talked about and how why there are so many different stakeholders and there are old laws from, you know, a century and a half ago that are in a sense partially governing new needs for states like New Mexico. So first of all, where does most of New Mexico, just big picture, get its water from?
So about half of New Mexico's water use is from groundwater. So basins that have, you know, aquifers that are underground, and then half of the water comes from surface water sources such as the Rio Grande, the San Juan River, which is a tributary to the Colorado, brings water into New Mexico. It's actually our largest source of water, so it's typically half and half of the surface and groundwater. Obviously, we're really subject to when the drought gets bad, the surface water tends to go away, and so you're more reliant on groundwater. So you do have a negative effect to groundwater supplies over time if you're consistently trying to augment your surface supply with that groundwater use.
Okay. So for the surface supply before augmentation from groundwater, it sounds like, though, that's also water that maybe other states also might rely on?
Yes, absolutely. So we have 8 interstate compacts within the state of New Mexico, which means we share water with other states. We're right in the throes of a big lawsuit with Texas, Texas v. New Mexico. That's you know, contesting that New Mexico is not delivering the water we should be to their state in that compact. We're also part of the Colorado River issues. The San Juan's a tributary to the Colorado. So those 7 basin states, New Mexico is one of them, we're right in the throes of trying to figure out solutions on the Colorado system. So we've got litigation threats, which are very real, and trying to protect the water for New Mexico. And so you have a really complex situation that that's out there in you know, a lot of different areas.
Yeah. And so in New Mexico then also, how much of typically of the water is used for agricultural purposes?
80% of New Mexico's water is agricultural use.
80%?
80%, yes.
Have those have the farmers and the ag companies, have they had to reduce their water usage?
Yes, they have. In fact, we've got fallowing programs that have been put in place. And quite frankly, just because there's a lack of water use, the West was developed with Bureau of Reclamation projects and programs in the early 1900s. And in order to get the population to move here, you had to dam the water, create a water supply, because all of it came in the spring and you wouldn't have water the rest of the year. Over those years, as those projects developed, there is a certain amount of acreage for those particular projects, and they're all suffering shortages. So if they need 3 acre feet of water, an acre foot of water is 326,000 gallons essentially. So you're talking about 1 million gallons of water. If each acre needs 1 million gallons of water, or 3 feet. So when we say 3 feet of water, they're only getting 3 inches in many cases now. And so you can imagine we're not using that water because it's not there, but the farming community is suffering. And what we're trying to do is in years like this is provide opportunities for the agricultural folks to fallow some of the land until times get better, which means government or others paying to fallow so that they don't use that water. And they can do some internal banking. So maybe cobble together 4 or 5 farms' water that would go to each one of them, maybe go to one farm, and then take the other ones out of production for a short period of time.
Okay. So I'm seeing here that New Mexico has done a pretty good job or making efforts to reduce municipal water usage, because making systems more efficient there, so there's less loss, essentially. But at the same time, there's just less overall water. So how is that playing out in in farming and agriculture. And actually, now I'm looking at the clock and I'm running out of time here. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually just going to hold that question for when we come back from the break, so I don't rush you off the air here. We're taking a close look at New Mexico today and how the state is coping with, again, this mega drought, the Western mega drought, the worst in 1,200 years, and what it specifically means for New Mexico and the way of life there. We'll be back with more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at how New Mexico is coping with the worst drought in the American West in 1,200 years. And by the way, I've said that a couple of times this hour because it's like such a eye-opening and disturbing number, but that number comes from a study from the University of California, Los Angeles. And scientists from UCLA looked at tree ring data, as far as the trees could go back and offer us that data. And they found that the period from the year 2000 to 2021, according to those tree rings, formed the driest 22-year period in American West history since the year 800 AD. So it's the driest 22 years in the past 1,200 years. And we're living through it right now. So again, how is New Mexico coping? I'm joined today by John D'Antonio. He served as New Mexico's top water official from 2003 to 2011 and again from 2019 to 2021. And he's co-owner and principal program director of American West Water Advisors. And Mr. D'Antonio, I wanted to just stick with ag and water use in New Mexico for another quick second, because I do wonder, you were talking about fields being purposely made fallow in order to cope with the reduced amount of water, but with the perpetual dryness that's also going on, has that not had the effect of extending the irrigation season because it's just so much drier for so much longer?
Absolutely. And Meghna, that's really a good point, because that's contributed to additional water use. And what we've had to do is actually go in and put some limits on starting irrigation. Irrigation typically starts March 1 here in New Mexico. This past year in the Middle Rio Grande, we delayed that to the last 2 years till April 1, and then we've shortened it on the back end. Usually there's irrigation till in through October, and we shortened it to about September, or, you know, September 15th or so. Like, so we've had to physically shorten the season ourselves because the warming temperatures have allowed more water to be put to beneficial use. Now there's always going to be a competition for water for growing municipalities, and one of the things that I think I want to stress is we're considered a fully appropriated state when it comes to surface water. So there's no new appropriations that the state engineer gives out in most every single basin within the state of New Mexico. But what we do allow for is what we call a change in place and purpose of use, which means the cities are continue to grow, but what we require for them to do is to offset the effects that they have on groundwater pumping, because essentially they have to pump more groundwater. So they have to go out and acquire farmland or another water right, transfer that, just that consumptive use, over to the city for the city to be able to grow. Now the city of Albuquerque, for instance, they've done a fantastic job on conservation. When they started using their San Juan Chama water allocation, which is renewable water that surface water, and instead of just relying on groundwater, they've actually rebuilt the aquifer a little bit as a drought reserve. So their per capita use was close to 250 gallons per person per day when I first became state engineer. When we permitted their San Juan Chama diversion project, we required them to go down to 150 gallons per person per day. And actually, they've gotten down, I think, to about 120 on their own in compliance with the permit. But on their own, they've even reduced it further. So the cities in New Mexico, for the most part, have grown without using additional water. But that's to date. You know, it's kind of hard to continue to think that that water use is not going to continue over time, but you're essentially right. You're pitting the growth in the municipal and industrial developments against ag water.
Yeah.
And we do have enough to make that transfer, but it's a little bit tenuous in some areas.
So we always get this question whenever we do water and the West stories, because people hear about the vast majority being used for agriculture, and folks ask, well, you know, if the government can pay farmers to not farm fields in order to save water, why not permanently reduce the percentage of water that's being used by ag? How would you answer that?
Well, that's happened, and it's happened in a couple of different cases. One in our Pecos River area, we had some challenges from Texas on a lawsuit. We instituted what we called a buy and dry program, in which we actually, when I say we, the state of New Mexico, purchased land, farms, took them out of production until the Pecos River became into more of a hydrologic balance. And it's worked great because now we're in a major credit status to the state of Texas in on that particular river. What we're looking now in the lower Rio Grande is not necessarily a buy and dry, but looking more at maybe rotational fallowing, but turning around and taking some of the production, taking some farmland out of production at different times. But every 2 years, you really need to put them back in production because of the topsoil issues. You still need soil protection and things of that nature. So it gets a little bit tricky when you do it. But honestly, we're looking at reducing some agricultural use in a lot of those areas. And quite frankly, some of the agricultural uses really aren't benefiting everybody. I mean, we've got a lot of exportation of product that goes to China, for instance, or pecans that go to China. We're really exporting our water to China. You think about that, maybe not as much in New Mexico, but even in the Ogallala or wherever else that we're experiencing these shortages. But we're not only giving agricultural product, we're essentially giving other countries our water, because that's what it takes to develop those commodities.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a real interesting dilemma, I think.
Wow. I mean, the conversion of natural resources into commerce. I mean, that's the story of humankind, isn't it?
But, it is.
But, you know, we also get a lot of people who write in and say, well, people shouldn't be living where there's no water to begin with anyway. But I will note that according to census data, over the past 10 years, New Mexico has only grown by about 2.8% in its population. So its rate of population growth is less than other states in the American West. So it's not as if people are flooding in huge amounts, like, say, compared to Texas or something, to New Mexico. But Mr. D'Antonio, how long have you lived there?
I'm a native. I was born in Albuquerque, and so yeah, I've been here my whole life, and I've seen it. I've seen it change. I've seen it get drier and drier. You know, in New Mexico, we have a 400-year history of community sharing water in times of shortages. We've got, you know, besides, and I haven't mentioned the acequias, which are northern. Typically northern New Mexico communities that have subsistence farming, essentially, but they've been doing it for 400 years. We've got the 23 tribes, pueblos, and nations that have been doing it since time immemorial. And we have developed these relationships where there's a concept that the acequias use. It's called repartimiento, and it's a sharing of shortages, and they determine what the supply is at the beginning of the year. And they share that shortage. And so they only plant as much as they can actually produce, given a known quantity of water. And that's what we've been going to over the last 20 years in these conflicts that we have in a lot of the basins. And that's kind of back to the Active Water Resource Management Initiative. How do we put stakeholder-driven solutions together, not top-down driven, where I'm turning, when I was state engineer, to turn off water use, but to go in and put these rules and regulations that allow for short-term transfers, especially from some of the ag uses to other uses to get us through droughts. And then when we have a more normal supply, you go back to a normal supply of water. And there's more conservation we can put in place. And I haven't even talked about other sources of water. I mean, we've got brackish water, through desalination, inland desalination. We've got produced water that can be cleaned up on oil and gas production. And you mentioned moving water. You can actually move bulk water transfers from some locations to other locations if you have the right area of origin protections. You don't want to create another Owens Valley like you had in California. So it's very tricky. It's I can't say enough about increased data and more information on our water data exchange, which is growing because water managers need adequate information on a real-time basis so they can make decisions that that help everybody.
Yeah, can you hold that thought? Because I want to come back to that because there is some proposed legislation around water data that I want to talk to you about. But, you know, I just want to go back to that study out of UCLA with that tree ring data. You know, so they look back to 800 AD, Common Era, whatever you want to call it, 1,200 years into the past. And the other conclusion that the UCLA scientists draw is that it's not just that we're in the driest period of the past 1,200 years, but that it's not even so much that a reduced amount of precipitation is the main driving factor. They say the tree ring data shows that it's climate change that's exacerbating the drought. So I wonder if even drought, Mr. D'Antonio, is the right word to use anymore, because it doesn't sound as if a couple of years of heavy snowfall or better rainfall is going to solve this problem.
You're absolutely right. And so, you know, warmer temperatures, they cause lower river flows. There's increased evaporation. We've got this what we call antecedent moisture conditions where even though we get some precipitation, the moisture conditions are so low by the time the water starts running off, it's absorbed by those conditions. And so what's translated into the tributaries in the rivers is a lot less volume. So, when you couple the warming temperatures with just even a level form of precipitation, you get a major – you still get the concern of a major impact with respect to, climate change. It's just hurting – it's hurting everybody. The other thing I might add, we're getting more extreme events, which means more flooding in certain locations, and we really don't have the infrastructure in place for those extreme events. We need more flood control structures that are dual water supply projects that we could potentially capture that runoff and maybe re-inject it or put a lot more storage underground to take the evaporative loss factor out of it. And so, I see that particular need. It's hard to build dams in the West just because of all the environmental concerns. And even the Corps of Engineers is starting to convert some of their flood control structures into dual-purpose water supply projects to enhance that infiltration, that recharge, and have the ability to use additional water. And so those things are starting to happen. But we need a whole lot more of it and taking advantage of a lot of the federal funds that are out there now. You know, I think we really should start prioritizing those types of projects.
Mm. So back to the water data question. And it's fascinating to me because it really, we're talking about a permanent change in the way of life in the West. And so part of coping with that change or living with that new change, you said, requires better information. And I note that New Mexico's congressional delegation is proposing the Water Data Act, which would be some kind of national framework to centralize water data to help decision making. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. That one is it's been in place for a couple of years. The vision of it is to for New Mexico to have accessible and useful data for water management and planning. And really, we need it all over the place. But the goals are easy access to key water data sets, common water data standards and definitions. Data gaps will be identified and prioritized. And also accessible water data. It's useful for decision making. We look at trying to get as much transparency out to the public, put it in our managing and planning documents. And so you can't do anything without good information and good data. We're working in conjunction even with the Western States Water Council. There's an Internet of Water that is starting to fund a lot of projects. And so the states, the Western states, through a lot of these different venues are sharing data because, as you know, water doesn't respect political and geopolitical boundaries. We need the information and data because we do have so many interstate compacts. We're sharing water. We're looking at solutions that are regional solutions. And it takes that information and data so that we can plan and put them in place. So in March 1, if we have a really poor snowpack and it doesn't get better by April 1, which is the key, we already have a mechanism in place to allow us to transfer that water. And we've got the wheels in motion already so we can manage ourselves through some of these challenging times. And that gets back to the Active Water Resource Management Initiative. But you can't do it without really good and sound data.
Yeah. Through these challenging times, but these times are what the sounds like the present and the future for New Mexico and the West is going to be for the foreseeable future. I just wonder, we've got about a minute left, Mr. D'Antonio. Can you just tell me kind of like what are some of the ways that the issue of water just permeates day-to-day life in New Mexico that we might not think about? Because again, when everything changes around you, it might be kind of sometimes hard to wrap your head around how those changes are having an impact on your life. But this is an inescapable one.
Well, yeah, and I think the biggest thing is, it affects the water supply, also affects water quality. So what's constantly, I think, on people's mind now, and it didn't used to be that way. You turn the faucet, you get your water, you're going, hey, where did that come from? I don't know, but it's there, right? But now conservation, we're looking at recycling, reuse, renewable sources. Brackish water, which is being used more a lot in different states, Texas especially, that desalination of deep brackish water is an opportunity. We have to look at produced water, cleaning that up, even maybe some climate modification, and just making sure we're paying attention to the administrative aspect of the water and the fairness quality for all New Mexicans.
Well, John D'Antonio served as New Mexico's top water official from 2003 to 2011 and then again from 2019 to 2021. He's co-owner and principal program director of American West Water Advisors. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.